Welcome to China Manufacturing Decoded from Sofeast, the podcast where we take you through some of the major topics facing importers and manufacturers in China today.
Hello, listener. Thanks for joining us here on China Manufacturing Decoded. You're listening to episode 51. Adrian from Sofeast here, and I'm joined as ever by our CEO, Renaud. And this week, we're discussing 9 things that smaller importers may not be able to negotiate with Chinese and Southeast Asian suppliers, and of course, why that might be the case. Renaud, thanks for joining me.
Hey, how are you doing?
Yeah, fine, thanks. Fine. Finally, over here in Europe, things seem to be improving a little bit. So I'm looking forward to that with a hopeful attitude as we're coming into spring as well.
Yes. And here, really, nothing is changing. Still, on the China side, no problem. Most people don't wear masks and everything. On the Hong Kong side, people are not very enthusiastic about taking the vaccine. And, still everybody still needs a working visa or something like that to go into China, all the foreigners anyway. So not much influx into China.
Plus the long quarantine period as well.
Yes. Not very attractive to...
Everything's still got to be remote at the moment. Although hopefully as the situation evolves, the Chinese authorities will accept people who have been vaccinated abroad.
That's what they say they are going to do, yes. But not immediately. They say probably the BioNTech in July and, little by little they will do that. Yeah. But I guess they will also request reciprocity for their own vaccines. Let's see.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that would make sense, I suppose, for Chinese people who are actually going to go outside as well. But there's some hope now that, if you do need to get over to China, perhaps it might be possible this year a little bit more easily.
Yeah, sometime this year. Let's see. I want to be optimistic.
Right. Well, fingers crossed. So today's topic, what can't small importers negotiate with Chinese and Southeast Asian suppliers? So that could be from countries like Vietnam, which is popular, for instance. I guess, first of all, it's important to define what is a small importer.
Right. Well, it's always relative, right? It's always relative to the size of the supplier. I mean, I remember talking to some clients and doing some due diligence into their suppliers, and some of them were working with literally, a tiny workshop of, I don't know, it was like a garage with, or a couple of garages with, 6 people doing, putting some jewelry together or things like that. And in that case, you are a significant customer pretty fast, right? And of course, if you work with a manufacturing facility of 10,000 people, especially if it's highly automated and they have very high output, well, it's kind of hard to be a big customer of theirs, right? So it is relative. However, let's say you buy, when you place an order, it is $10,000 or $50,000, but no more than that. This usually in China is considered a small buyer.
Right. Okay. So when we're looking at really big buyers, then you're looking in the millions, maybe even more.
A big buyer is a buyer that buys $10 million a year of that specific product. That starts to be, could say a big buyer. Yeah.
Okay. So the focus then is on the smaller businesses, and there are a number of points that it's difficult for this size of organization to negotiate. So if you can kick it off with the first one, that is negotiating with large contract manufacturers in many countries.
Right. So it's funny because the press, is always looking at what the really big guys are doing. And thinking of all the smaller buyers looking at that, you know, what exactly are they learning from that? You know, can they go to these huge Taiwanese contract manufacturers, can or Korean, or, you know, can they go to these guys and talk and say, hey, yeah, you know, let's reserve these all these production lines and so on? No. So that's the world of these huge huge organizations that really organize the supply chain, and most of them are not great at manufacturing. You know, their quality, if the buyer is not spending a lot of time and energy and engineering resources to really get things straight, their quality is not amazing. You know, there are issues, and sometimes they cheat on some of the components and so on. So it's not like paradise. However, they are great at organizing the supply chain and, you know, really, how to say, making the best of the big volumes that they are getting from their customers. And they have a lot of weight over the component suppliers, and they can negotiate good deals, and they can, you know, they orchestrate all of that to minimize the chances that some of the parts or the materials will not be ready on time, you know, and they have relatively sophisticated planning systems in place for that, and so on and so forth. So that's something that you can look into if you are, you know, a big buyer. You know, so there's a lot of talk about the big electronics guys, you know, the Amazons and the HPs and the Apple, of course, and so on, because it is, how to say, there's really like this industry of contract manufacturers, and you kind of get to know, oh, okay, so who's making the Surface computers of Microsoft? Oh, it's in Pegatron in Suzhou. Oh, okay, yeah. Well, I've been there. You know, it's there's 40,000 people there on the site. I don't know now, but at the time, I don't know, 6 years ago. Great, you know, and Pegatron is a pretty good company. Mm-hmm. You know, better at manufacturing than most of the competitors. But again, if I'm a small buyer, what can I take away from that? Not much. If I'm a small buyer, I'm not going to go in and say, well, you know, we have this product that's like half developed, but we need a lot of your help, of your engineering resources to do that, you know, you already have all the suppliers ready to go for that. So you just tell us which ones are a good fit, and, you know, help us negotiate good pricing. And by the way, this and these parts, we already know who is going to make them. And you're going to have to orchestrate all that and develop the new product and manage all the tooling and so on. And you're going to have to sign this crazy contract and so on. You know, and we can come anytime, and you have to do all of these things for us. No. Small buyers have to look for much smaller companies.
Hmm.
And the resources are really not the same. Let's say it this way. And the patience also is really not the same if you develop your own new products. you know, you can't just have them work on really complicated things for 6 months or 1 year. I mean, after a while, you just say, ah, oh, you know, finish, you know, next one. Sorry, we you know, we lost patience. There's just too many hurdles, too many complexities. Right. So you got to forget about what you read in the press, basically.
Yeah. Well, you've said before, even if you're a smaller company and you manage to get one of these large contract manufacturers to take on your project, you might not even get the best possible service from them in comparison to a smaller CM.
Oh, for sure. For sure you would not, because where are the best product managers going to be working? You know, on the biggest projects, right? And when, I don't know, when Amazon says, oh, this new whatever generation of tablets, whatever, it's really urgent, and you know, you signed this contract and you're running late and you're going to have a lot of penalties and whatever, then you know, all the resources are put there, you know.
Yeah, and we know what's going to happen to your order.
Well, yeah, right. Things are just going to get to a very very slow pace. It's mm-hmm. going to become very cold right away.
Mm. Okay, so out of the 9 points then, so we're on to number two. So what's your second point?
Mm. So you can really reserve production capacity. So again, let's take another example. Let's say you purchase garments, and you know roughly what kind of garment you're going to make. Let's say it's always, you know, denim, jeans. Now, you don't know exactly what the cut is going to be. You don't know exactly what the color is going to be, because, of course, your designers will sort of decide at the last moment. And they don't really know for sure what is going to be next year. In what they would design next year. However, you know that you are going to buy that many, you know, tons of grunge fabric anyway. And you know that you're going to be making at least, at least 1 million pairs of trousers, you know, and mm-hmm. that translates into, I don't know, whatever, you know, 15 sewing lines, busy all the time, all year round, right? And maybe maybe you have four seasons, and so it's maybe not exactly year round, but like with four small peaks. Okay, if you know that, you go to the really big guys and that have all these production lines and everything, and you tell them, hey, gonna reserve 15 production lines, you know, with some flexibility, but for sure I can reserve. And same thing with the cotton supplier, you know, and the dyeing houses. Hey, you know, I'm gonna need this capacity for sure, and I can commit to it, right? Yeah. We need to reserve it. Well, that's amazing, right? But as a small buyer, who's going to really believe in what you say? If you say, well, I'm going to to buy this next year, this much. You got to explain a little bit, you know, how come you have such confidence in your markets? Why, you know, are you sure about that? And how can you commit? And, you know, and what happens if you just disappear and we don't hear from you again, you know, because you don't have a reputation, you don't have anything like that. So it would be much harder to convince manufacturers to really, reserve, you know, a part of their capacity, really, like, you know, things like, you know, this, you know, you have to reserve whatever, you know, 20 lathe CNC machines for 2 weeks, you know, that month, you know. Well, mm-hmm. it means they cannot take large orders that will make good use of these CNC machines. They really have to trust your forecast. You know, are they really going to trust your forecast 6 months in advance, 1 year in advance? You know, you got to be good at explaining that.
Okay. And number three, negotiating directly with large sub-suppliers. So that's also a no-no, right?
So let's take my example of the previous point where you're going to make denim pants, and you know you have to buy, you know, that woven cotton fabric, and you know where it's made, and you can go and talk directly with the guys that make that. Well, that's interesting. That's possible starting at a certain point. Let's take another example. Your product is made of plastic, okay, and it's for a very specific application, and you want a very specific kind of polymer. Well, let's say you do all of your reliability testing and everything with a certain polymer from Chime, for example, or from DuPont or BASF. Do you think you're going to be able to buy it directly from DuPont or Chime or BASF, you know, or are you going to just buy what's available on stock in their authorized distributors? Yeah, that's what's going to happen. And same thing also, that very common case people ask us, what about the batteries? Yeah, can I just buy Samsung or Sony or Panasonic batteries from them? No, they're probably not even going to want to talk to you, but they have authorized distributors. You're going to have to deal with these guys. And of course, you have to trust that these authorized distributors are going to sell you the real stuff, right? Now, if you're a very big buyer and you buy the same kind of whatever nylon for 20 of your products, and these 20 products are made in five different manufacturing places, well, you can actually sort of pull everything together and go to, say, Chime. So it's a big Taiwanese plastic supplier.
Yes.
And you can say, hey, all together we buy that much plastic. You know, if we make you the directed supplier, we'll buy everything from you. But you know, you gotta give us some good terms and some good pricing and da 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 da. Well, if you're a pretty big supplier, that buyer, that can work. A lot of examples like that. I mean, the,
sure.
Even big companies. So I remember I was talking with someone from Valeo. Valeo makes a lot of automotive parts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a small company. You know, they're pretty large.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
Yeah, but they themselves feel very small when buying certain kinds of components.
Sure.
And they were pretty frustrated sometimes. Yeah, this kind of specific plastic, you know, it's very hard to reserve all the right capacity because at the time it was, you know, because the iPhone 6 is grabbing so much of it. And that's it, you know, we can't, we have to come after Apple. Apple already made the deal. And we come after that, right? A lot of stories like that.
No, okay, that makes sense, yeah. So on to number four.
Right, so you deal with your suppliers and you're going to ask them to give you some information. You want to understand their cost structure. Otherwise, it's too easy for them to say, oh, well, you know, the cost has to go up 10% this year. Why? Because, you know, the wages are going up and the taxes are going up and blah, 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 blah. By how much? What does it represent exactly? Blah, blah, blah. And you never get to an answer because they say, well, you know, oh, and we don't really make a profit on this and it's not really interesting. And and they don't want to tell you, okay, how many people work exactly on my production, or how many minutes does it consume? How much do you pay your people and things like that? It just doesn't happen if you are not a very big buyer. However, big buyers will be able from the start to negotiate, you know, through their contracts and all their requirements. You know, you just give us all the information. You don't want? Fine. We don't select you. We just go somewhere else. And so they have long forms to fill out. And you know, and you have to say, okay, and we use that many square meters of space for production and that much for warehouse and da-da-da. And this is what we pay. Yeah, we rent and we pay whatever, 25 RMB per square meter. And we do this and we do that. And the staff working there, they are paid that much plus this much in social security and blah blah blah, right? So they can do their little model, And sometimes it can be pretty nasty. You know, they will go there and say, well, based on what we see, you could reorganize things and you could consume half of the space that you're using, and you're using 30% too much labor. We're not paying for it, you know. So cut the price accordingly. Clack. Mm. You know, welcome to the auto industry, for example. Right? But small buyers don't want that. Suppliers don't want that. And they know that it's very, very uncommon for a small buyer to get that kind of visibility. So it just doesn't happen.
Mm. So how would you say to get some level of visibility if you are in the smaller bracket?
Well, at least you need to do a little bit of market research yourself to understand the price of the inputs to your production, you know, at least the key material or two or three materials that they buy or components. Yep. You need to have an idea about that. You need to have an idea also about the wages in that area for that kind of production. Now it can be a bit tricky. Like, for example, so our little manufacturing facility is in Dongguan. And I was talking with a friend of mine. He works in a company that also has a manufacturing facility in Dongguan, but they mm-hmm. make kitchenware. And well, their boss is, you know, a little bit tight-fisted, mm-hmm. always paying the you know, as little as he can. And then so he was asking me, so how much you pay per hour? And when I told him, it was like, wow, you know, we pay 30% more. How come? Well, yeah, I mean, most of what we do is electronics. We have to hire people who've been trained to that and who know how to do it well. Oh, okay. And and we want, you know, just want good people. Well, you know, that's a 30 to 35% difference already in hourly cost. Totally fully loaded, right? So it's not just a matter of, oh, they're in Dongguan, so they pay their staff, you know, 6,000 RMB or 7,000 RMB. Or, no. That's, mm-hmm. you get to know about the industry also. You get to know about the industry. So these are the little things that you can do just by collecting a little bit of information. And some suppliers might be okay to give you like a formula as a basis for the pricing. That's what we do. I mean, that's what we do. We say that's that many minutes, and that's the price per hour for operators. And oh, and that much, you know, that many whatever hours or minutes of inspection work, and in inspection work is billed at that much per hour. Well, that you know, I think a lot of suppliers could do that, but the problem is they don't want, because they want to be able to charge as much as they can. And when they think, oh, this guy, we can charge more, they will charge more. And oh, this product, we can charge more than that one for the same buyer. You know, they will often play games like that. A lot of smokes and mirrors. So
yeah. So assuming your supplier isn't as transparent as we try to be, in this case, doing your homework literally is worth money to you. If you've got that information to make sure that you're trying to keep them as accountable as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. I mean, it's then you can fight back when they say, "Oh, price goes up 15%." Okay, but based on my information, you know. You know, this is how much the materials have gone up. Actually, this material here has gone down. The wages in your area, from what I see, have gone up this much since last year. So give me your calculations, because I don't find the same results as you.
Yeah, I like it. Fighting back. That makes a lot of sense in this context. Yeah. I like that. Okay. So on to point five, and this is also about where we're trying to maybe enforce something on the factory. So that's forcing a factory to use your own ERP system.
Right. So very big buyers want their suppliers to feed information back into their own ERP system, you know, so they can track the progress of production, they can track a lot of things, and then they can use it to analyze, they can use it to know also when there's going to be a delay, to have some reassurance about how much inventory is coming to them soon and so on. Well, first, small buyers often do not even have an ERP. And if they tell the supplier, hey, you have to input all this information here in my system, well, there's always a little bit of resistance, you know. So it's got to be extremely simple. I have a client recently that invited with Microsoft, what is it, Nav? Yeah. They invited their suppliers and they made it very, very simple just to input this, for to request inspection and this, to request shipment and this, to say when they're going to be late. And also when they accept the order. It is like four touch points. Kept it very, very simple. We went them, gave some training to the suppliers. Most of them said okay, because, you know, there was a... it was give and take. They could have faster payments and things like that. So the buyer did give something in return, right? But that's like the exception. Most of the case, it's not like that. It's really not easy to get the suppliers to really, input information directly into your ERP.
Okay. And number six.
Well, payment terms, you know, open account payment terms. It's like open bar. It's whatever you like when you want, you know. And basically, it means that the suppliers just, they have a contract with the buyer and they ship out. They don't get paid anything. And, you know, they get paid 30 days after, 60 days after, sometimes 90 days after. Very big buyers can get away with a lot of things like that. And that's just not going to happen for a small buyer. I think it's pretty obvious to anybody that's been buying something in China. What is usually considered more or less standard is 30% down before production starts, and 70%, the payment of the remaining 70%, at least after final inspection, if possible after shipment.
Yeah.
Right. And then once the supplier gets that, they can send the bill of lading and everything that will be used to get the goods back. But that it's hard. It's very hard often to negotiate for better payment terms.
And number seven, it's the product warranty and liability from the supplier.
Well, if you buy, especially ODM, a product that already exists, you find on Alibaba, Global Sources, something, you say, oh yeah, I like this one, just put it in my packaging like this, and I'll be like basically your distributor. Under my brand, but still it's your product. Well, if you come back to them and say, hey, I have, 5% returns and it cost me that much and it wiped out all my margin and I'm, this is really not working. Here's the bill. You got to give me $20,000 to compensate for that for the previous order. Well, the supplier is going to say nothing. Just not going to reply. You're going to say bye-bye, next buyer. however, very big companies will negotiate all of this in advance, but large suppliers will usually be aware of that. They will ask the right questions to understand, okay, what's the, if there's that many defective, what's going to be the impact, the business impact, and how much is going to cost and so on. And if the buyer says yes, and we'll reinvoice all of that to you because you have to, you have to cover us for that. well, at least if it's manufacturing defects, of course, not if it's design defects, then the manufacturer is going to pad their pricing. And they're going to talk with the buyer about that, and they're going to try to maybe spend a little bit more time getting the product design and the process design to the point where most of the issues are avoided or detected and cut and reworked, because both of them are going to suffer if there's, you know, 3% defectives or 5% defectives. It might be a disaster. So they have to think about that and plan accordingly.
Right. And so for the smaller organization, inspections critical.
Yes, exactly. Do an inspection. If it's not good, stop it in the factory. Have it reworked in the factory, and don't let them ship it out. Yeah. Because after that, it's like, it's over.
Okay. And number eight, shaping the supply chain physically.
So over the past, 3 years since Trump put his tariffs in place and everybody kind of got afraid, we've heard of these big groups that said, oh, yeah, and we relocated production to Vietnam and relocated production to whatever, Mexico or Eastern Europe or something. And very often they actually, they're still subcontracting production, but they moved assembly, or should I say they forced their assembly supplier to move the assembly operations out of China.
Yeah.
You know? There's been a lot of that, especially to Vietnam, because it's so convenient to keep the same component sources and just send them by truck just over the border, right?
Yeah, so, we spoke about that before, northern Vietnam, and it's just on the border with China.
Yeah, right. So small buyers can really tell their supplier, you know, hey, you know, how about you move to Vietnam and Cambodia or whatever, and, you know. And that the buyer is going to be, okay, well, if 10 other customers tell me that, you know, I'll consider.
Right. So, I mean, if you've got a reason to want to move some of your supply chain to another country, but you're in the smaller league, then really it's just a case of trying to do the sourcing there.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And finally, number nine, which is the ability to have your own teams on site all of the time.
I think it's pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah.
If you are in Shenzhen, I get to know a bunch of people, you know, from Apple, and they had an office in let me see, just next to the Central Walk over there,
Canada,
I think.
Yeah.
And they well, why do they have an office there with people traveling all over China, you know, the different manufacturing sites and everything? Well, they have a lot of production there, so it's actually not that expensive to Apple to have all these people there, to, you know, the manufacturing specialists and the design engineers and the supply chain security specialists and so on and so forth. They don't, you know, it doesn't cost that much to Apple. But if you buy €1 million a year from China, from, you know, a couple of suppliers, you can't have a team following up on everything. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work in the economics.
Right. And so in this case, of course, outsource this kind of thing to people who are already in situ in China or Asia.
Yeah. That's why there's a lot of companies like ours. I mean, we're not the only ones.
Absolutely. So
if you can't, you know, have your own team there, but you still need the help, the support on the ground, well, you get to look for service providers that can help. Yeah,
absolutely. Sophies.com, just one of the suggestions. Great. Well, thanks for filling us in on those, Renaud. Those are a number of the tasks, activities that smaller organizations are going to struggle with in comparison to, you know, the huge ones like the Apples of this world that you've mentioned. Hopefully very enlightening for the listeners. So thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks, Adrian.
All right, thank you.
Talk to you next time. Yeah.
Thanks for joining us. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, don't forget to like and share, and you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all other places that you get your podcasts from. See you next time.